I have just one more section because our strategic planning days were four in number. So I don't know if I'm reading them in the order that they were prepared, but the last one that I'm going to read here is Meeting Together, is how it's titled. The difficulty is the members of the United Nations. They assemble together, but their heart is not clean. They meet together with unclean heart, therefore there is no solution. Whereas Krishna consciousness means those who are meeting on the platform of Krishna consciousness, they are meeting in cleansed heart. That is the difference. Cheto darpana marjanam. Therefore, that unity is very solid and sound. And with unclean heart, if we meet officially, there is no possibility of unity. United Nations, it may be in name, but in fact, it cannot be established. The warning is already there, and responsible leaders of religious sects must meet together and form a common platform of a league of devotees of the Lord. There is no need for self-realized souls to live in a secluded place. Perfect realized souls engaged in the service of the Lord are unafraid of Maya, just as law-abiding citizens of a state never fear the police. Such fearless devotees of God always speak scientifically about the existence of God, even at the risk of death. Such devotees of God feel compassion for the mass of people who have completely forgotten the Supreme Lord and who engage in the false pursuit of happiness that ends in the sense pleasures enjoyed by the hogs and dogs. So let us cooperatively work together to vigorously spread Krishna consciousness to the suffering humanity at large. Your country is great, and you are all good sons of America. Spread this knowledge so that America will still be greater in the eyes of the world. Keep this point of view in front of you and all your God brothers combined together so you may execute this mission. Just like our Krishna Conscious Society, you come to consult me about every activity because I can give you the common cause. Otherwise, there will be fighting. The government should be very expert to know the aim of life, the common cause, and they should train the people to work for the common cause. Then they will be happy and peaceful. But to assemble together and sit together, we require a place for congregation. Therefore, the temple of the Krishna consciousness movement is required to be established in various centers of the world, irrespective of the particular country's culture, philosophy, and religion. Krishna consciousness is so universal and perfect that it can appeal to everyone, irrespective of his position. Therefore, I fervently appeal to you, all present in this meeting, to extend your cooperation for successful execution of this great movement. Even Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he is God himself, Krishna himself, he felt alone, unable to do this task. So this is the position. You are cooperating. Therefore, I am getting the credit. Otherwise, alone, what could I do? This isn't broken up. Eka. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself wanted our cooperation. He is God, Krishna. Therefore, cooperation is a very important thing. Nobody should think that I've got so great ability, I can do. No. It is simply by cooperation we can do. Very big thing. United we stand, divided we fall. This is our... So be strong in pushing on Krishna consciousness, and Krishna will help. He is the strongest. Still, we must be combined together. Sankirtana. Sankirtana means many men combined together chanting. That is Sankirtana. Bahu. Bahu means many. Many combined together. That is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission. Combined together. All nations, all persons, they should combine together. There is hope in our society. Combination. There are Hindus. There are Muslims. There are Christians. There are black, white. Combine them. That looks very beautiful. Just like combination of many flowers. There is black flower also. It looks very nice. Very nice. Each and every flower, take alone. It is not beautiful, but when they are combined together, it looks very beautiful. It is attractive. That is wanted. Because from the spiritual platform, we are all working. Pandita Samadarshanaha. Spiritual platform. Every one of us, we are servant of Krishna. So where is the competition between one servant with another? There is, even there is competition, the center is Krishna. Who can serve Krishna more? Therefore, that competition is very welcome because there is no personal interest. Everyone is trying how to serve Krishna more. That is wanted. The competition is there in the real form and perverted form. In the real form, Krishna is the center, and the perverted form, I am the center. I think for Krishna's sake, we shall try to work together, even at the risk of little personal inconvenience. Our foremost concern is Krishna. If Krishna's service is well done, then we should try to forget our personal inconveniences. Therefore, we must meet at least once a year in Mayapur. Not only GBC shall meet, but many devotees from all parts of the world. In Mayapur, we now have facilities to accommodate more than 1,000 people. We have a four-story building and enough space so that even on the balcony we can accommodate thousands. Apart from the rooms. There are all marble floors. And there is always natural ventilation. At least next March, we must meet together. Everything is progressing in a spirit of mutual cooperation in all respects. This is Krishna consciousness, working together to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Practically, now it is in the hands of you big guns to manage everything so that there may be never internal difficulties amongst us and so that we may always go on increasing more and more the influence of Lord Chaitanya's philosophy of Sankirtan process upon all the world. That will be your great achievement, and if you go on helping me in this way, you may know for certain that very soon you will see Krishna face to face. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So continue, Bhagavad Gita.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo
Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
We'll read the two verses that are together next is texts 3 and 4 from chapter 15. Translation: the real form of this tree cannot be perceived in this world. No one can understand where it ends, where it begins, and where its foundation is. But with determination, one must cut down this strongly rooted tree with the weapon of detachment. Thereafter, one must seek that place from which, having gone, one never returns, and there surrender to that Supreme Personality of Godhead, from whom everything began and from whom everything has extended since time immemorial. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. It is now clearly stated that the real form of this banyan tree cannot be understood in this material world, since the root is upwards. The extension of the real tree is at the other end. When entangled with material expansions of the tree, one cannot see how the tree extends, nor can one see the beginning of this tree. Yet one has to find out the cause. Quote, I am the son of my father, my father is the son of such and such person, etc. By searching in this way, one comes to Brahma, who is generated by the Garbhadakshayi Vishnu. Finally, in this way, when one reaches the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that is the end of research work. One has to search out that origin of this tree, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, through the association of persons who are in knowledge of that Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then, by understanding, one becomes gradually detached from this false reflection of reality, and by knowledge one can cut off the connection and actually become situated in the real tree. Paragraph. The word asanga is very important in this connection, because the attachment for sense enjoyment and lording it over the material nature is very strong. Therefore, one must learn detachment. By discussion of spiritual science based on authoritative scripture, and one must hear from persons who are actually in knowledge. As a result of such discussion in the association of devotees, one comes to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then, the first thing one must do is surrender to Him. The description of that place whence, having gone, one never returns to this false reflected tree is given here. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, is the original root from whom everything has emanated. To gain the favor of that Personality of Godhead, one has only to surrender. And this is the result of performing devotional service by hearing, chanting, etc. He is the cause of the extension of the material world. This has already been explained by the Lord Himself. Aham sarvasya prabhavo. I am the origin of everything. Therefore, to get out of the entanglement of this strong banyan tree of material life, one must surrender to Krishna. As soon as one surrenders to Krishna, one becomes detached automatically from this material extension. There's a woven back and forth in this purport, and for that matter in this whole final section of the Bhagavad Gita, is this theme of the role of knowledge in the application of bhakti. And sometimes you find statements that go this way and sometimes statements that go that way. The statements that go this way say, bhakti alone is sufficient. And there's statements that go on this side that say that knowledge is necessary to create the detachment so that one can engage in bhakti properly. And certainly, within Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is presenting knowledge. I mean, headings of chapters are transcendental knowledge, so there's no getting around it, no denial that knowledge is important. The balance position is that knowledge alone is not enough, or the real value of knowledge is that it's applied in devotional service to Krishna. And real knowledge becomes realized knowledge when it's applied in devotion to Krishna. There's a very interesting discussion, a transcribed discussion between Srila Prabhupada and Professor Durkheim, a German professor. I don't know professor of what, but Srila Prabhupada and the professor were discussing the position of knowledge. And Durkheim was taking the position that the purpose of knowledge doesn't have to have a purpose. Knowledge for knowledge's sake. And Prabhupada was taking a position, no. What's the practical application of knowledge? Knowledge without practical application is meaningless, worthless. And Durkheim was saying, don't need application, just knowledge. Knowledge for knowledge's sake. Prabhupada was being very gentle and gentlemanly with him, but Durkheim was not moving. So Prabhupada got out his hammer and hammered him. He didn't surrender, but from the perspective of a transcendent, what's the use of something? Palena parachiyate. A thing is judged by its fruit, pala. So if one has theoretical knowledge, but one's life is abominable, one's character and quality is abominable, what's that? So the purpose of knowledge is to elevate one's quality and character. And specific to this section of the 15th chapter here, asanga, detachment, sangha and asanga, coming together and breaking the attachment to this reflection of the material world. Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavatam that all beings wish freedom. They wish to experience, he says it very poetically, very, very beautifully, that the free spirit wishes to be unfettered by so many circumstances and enjoy that happiness that's unrestricted. We don't want happiness that's restricted or happiness that's sometimes and distress that's sometimes. But that's the material experience. It's happiness, distress. Sometimes happiness, sometimes distress. And even that happiness, because it's flickering and mixed with unwanted things, it's also not the happiness that we aspire for. We aspire for happiness that's unmixed and ever-increasing. And it's universal. It's universal. And there's a reason why it's universal. Why is it? What does that say? That we're all aspiring like that. Just like the quizzical question that says, everyone wants to live forever, but they must die. Why is that? Why is it that everyone wants to live forever? And why is it that we must die? It says something. To a thoughtful person, it says something. By nature, we live forever. And we don't want to die. Prabhupada's comment is, even an insect. The ant is walking along the floor and you put your hand down and the ant will go around your hand and keep going. He wants to continue. And you like push him the other way and he'll come back. We want life that is eternal. We want sat. We want chit. We want ananda. We want them because it's our nature. But this place is achit, asat, and nirananda. Just being thoughtful can tell you these things. Without reading scripture, just be thoughtful. But few people are thoughtful. So how to regain that? That then there must be detachment from the asat, that which is temporary. And the temporary is of the nature of fruitive activity. That which is produced from the mode of passion. Fruitive activity. And the fruits of those of fruitive activity. And the destinations where one may go to enjoy a higher standard of sense gratification. In this world, people aspire for a higher grade of sense enjoyment. It's just everywhere you go, you see it. And then those that are a little more in the mode of goodness, it's attain a heavenly situation of sense pleasure. And that's the expectation. It's not just attain heaven, but it's a heavenly standard of sense gratification. I was visiting once in Puerto Rico because for years I had done book distribution there when the airport became legal for book distribution. So I was going back to visit the devotees. And on the way from the airport to the temple is a farm property up on a mountainside, very beautiful, scenic. And you look on the other side of the valley and there's, I forget what it is in Spanish, but it's a rainforest, cuenca or something like that, a rainforest. So it's a very beautiful setting for a temple. And to get there from the airport, there's just driving through this valley area, and we were going along the road, and there was a church, and right next to the church, there was this huge, like, you could barely put a paper in between the two buildings, a huge, an apartment building coming up right next to the church, and I looked at the thing and said, "What's that?" And the driver said, "Oh, that's Pastor Reverend so-and-so. I said, well, what's the building? He said, this man is a very popular and at the same time unpopular priest. He's popular amongst those that come to his church because they go to his church and he says, pray to God for prosperity. It works. And people that go to his place, they pray to God for prosperity and they become prosperous. So he got the great idea, just come and live right next to the church and you can come every morning and pray to God for prosperity. We'll build a high-rise apartment right next to the church. You can come every morning and pray for prosperity. So everyone was wanting to pay for a place in his prosperity palace next to the church. He said, and all the people are going to his church because they get the message. And the other priest realized that's not the message, but he's attracting people because he's giving that message. And it works. The cheaters and the cheated. And the Bhagavatam's message is dharma projita kaitavotra. Such cheating processes that the purpose of religion is material prosperity in this life and the next. Commonly people think that way. Krishna says that in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Most people think that's the purpose of the Vedas and there's nothing else. He says it right in Bhagavad Gita. And I've experimented with different audiences in different parts of the world, including here in India. And that's what people think. Oh, In fact, it was twice in India. Once was the University of Jaipur, another was in New Bombay. A big assembly, so many people. So I started the presentation saying, you're all people that I don't know, and you don't know me. So we'll begin just by getting a general sense of what our values are. So listen carefully, and I'm going to explain something. And if you agree, wait till the end. And if you agree, please put up your hand. So at the University of Jaipur, it was like the hall was half of this, but it was really long and narrow, like this room. And the place was packed, and I was up on a little raised platform like this, so I'm looking out at the audience and say, how many would you agree that the following is a true statement? The purpose of the Vedas is to lead a pious life so that the fruits of your piety entitle you in this life to prosper and enjoy piously, nicely, but enjoy, and after this life attain a heavenly destination. Well, you will enjoy even more. How many would agree that that's the purpose of the Vedas, the message of the Vedas? Everybody raised their hand. Everybody raised their hand. So I said, okay, is there anybody that in the room that has a different point of view? One girl, way in the back, because girls have to sit in the back, raised her hand. And I said, oh, you're a brave person. You're greatly outnumbered, but what's your point of view? What's the purpose of the Vedas? The purpose of the Vedas is to know Krishna. And the only way that one can know Krishna is through devotional service. By simply engaging everything that one has in the service to Krishna, one can come to realize Krishna. That's the purpose of the Vedas. I said, wow, you must be reading Srila Prabhupada's books. And she said, yes, I've been reading Prabhupada's books. And very clearly it says, right in the Vedas, that's the purpose of the Vedas. She quoted the verse. That's the purpose of the Vedas, to know Krishna. But how many people understand that? Although it's right in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, the A, B, C, Bhagavad Gita. And here it is, in another verse of Bhagavad Gita. Cut this fruitive activities program through the Vedas. Krishna says it more than one place in Bhagavad Gita. Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nishtrigunya Pavarjana. Same message. The Vedas deal mainly with the three modes of material nature. Rise above the modes of material nature. Be transcendental to all of them. Doesn't say trash the Vedas, but that purpose, which the preponderance of persons feel is the purpose of the Vedas, is not the purpose of the Vedas. It's right in the beginning, chapter 2. So here it is, chapter 15, saying the same thing, only in metaphorical language, describing the picture of life and its source of emanation, saying specifically, no one knows that source of emanation. Krishna has already said that in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. No one, for all living beings, this is very logical, for all living beings that take birth, no one can know their source of emanation. Unpack that, and it's before you existed. How can you know what existed before you existed? Answer, you can't, because it existed before you existed. So how are you to know what existed before you existed, or before creation took place? How are you to know? And Krishna supplies the answer. You're to know by the disclosure from he who existed before you existed. And then you can know. And otherwise you can't know. And it's true, you can't know. You can say perhaps, maybe. In my opinion, it seems that by inference, the best logical conclusion I can reach is blah, blah, blah. But you don't know. And in fact, it's not blah, blah, blah. It's Krishna is the source. And you can't find out Krishna by that method of speculation. It's just not knowable. Sri Brahma Samhita confirms. Pantasta koti saravatsara sambhragomyo vayoratapi manaso munipungavanam. You can travel as fast as the wind, or even faster than the wind, as fast as the mind, and build a craft that goes that fast and search for the what's beyond this universe, and you won't find it. What's the source of everything? You won't find it, because it's beyond the capacity of the mind, and it's beyond the capacity of the senses. It's in another dimension. However fast the craft goes, that's of some material energy. You won't get there. It's not by speculation that what is the source of everything can be known. So he says in this verse that the origin of this tree, no one knows. But then he discloses, I am the source. Then you can know. And otherwise you can't know. I was just reading a dialogue between Srila Prabhupada and another scholar, Professor Benson. This one was a scientist. I think Durkheim was a philosopher, professor of philosophy, and Dr. Benson is a scientist of some type. And Prabhupada was hammering, the purpose of science is to know the source of all things, and Krishna is the source of all things, so the purpose of science is to know Krishna. And he was saying other things, and Prabhupada was smashing his other things and saying that science is to know Krishna. And you should use your intellect, you're an intelligent man, use your intellect to understand and teach about Krishna. And towards the end of the whole dialogue, Benson said, the problem is I have difficulty in just accepting something that's unknown. And Prabhupada gave the example of a small child. I forget, you know, some object. This is a microphone. So the child doesn't know. But the child says, Mommy, Daddy, what is this? And Mommy, Daddy says, this is microphone. Okay, it's microphone. And so they may not have a mature understanding of what microphone is, but that's what it is. And as they become older and a little more mature, they have a proper understanding of what a microphone is. And similarly, we can't know Krishna other than through that source of someone who knows, which is exactly what he's saying here. Then you can know. And you may not be in a mature stage of knowing. That's okay. At least you know. Instead of saying blah blah and saying that's what it is. Big Bang or something. I had a college program once at University of Houston in Texas, and it was the group that was sponsoring the talk was the Graduate Indian Student Association, GISA, the acronym. It was a lecture hall that was, you know, shaped like a bowl, so it's like, you know, you have eye contact always with the professor, and the professor could have eye contact with them. And the presentation was on mysteries of the sacred universe. It was Sataputta's book put into a video form, and I took video clips and explained the structure of the universe. And it's very technical, but they were able to follow it. And at the end, one of the students said, because you've prefaced that one of the wonderful things of the Vedic picture of the universe is that it's measurable, it's empiric. Because in those same Vedas that speak about Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill when he was 7 years old, it speaks about empirical things. The size of planets, the distance between this planet and that planet, the period of their rotation. Measurable empirical things. That was existing long, long, long before before there was the kind of technology that has today, where it says the size of the planets, the distance between the planets, and so forth and so on, and you do all the calculations, and it's practically a one-to-one correspondence. When in history, prior to Copernicus, there was the view where Earth is the center. It's called geocentric. Copernicus came along and said heliocentric. And it was a revolution between the old people and the new people. You know how scientists are. No, it's this. Oh, it's that. And they fought. Then he gave dimensions of the distance between the Earth and the Sun and the size of the Sun by use of a telescope. And he gave a number that was off by a multiplier of something like 95. Almost 100 times off. Something like that. And then through a period of time, more technology, and it got closer and closer and closer. Now, with Hubble telescopes mounted on spacecraft that fly around, zoom, 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 and take pictures and send the pictures back at different positions, and they measure the this angle, that angle, where the picture was taken from, and the size of the object. And now they have numbers that say the distance between this planet and that planet is X. And guess what? It's practically a one-to-one correlation. They're getting close to the right number of what the Vedas say. So without advancement of technology, they had all this very elevated science. And in that elevated science, it says the source of everything is Krishna. Now, modern science, with all their telescopes and so on, technology, the source of everything is nothing. And what's the basis for that is they have their speculations. And one of the students said, in modern physics, down to microseconds before the Big Bang, they can mathematically calculate where everything was, because they just go back in time and show, you know, the expanding universe and where things are now, and they measure where they were some number of years ago, and so they can say where it started from, and down to milliseconds before the Big Bang they can calculate quantifiably. And then I said, well, what does that tell you? He said, well, where before the Big Bang, there was, you know what they say there was? What existed before the Big Bang? Huh? Say it again. A singularity. And what's a singularity? It's far out. It's unlimited mass in a dimensionless point. And then and the mass went flying all over the place. If you want another universe, just find another singularity and push the plunger and off it goes. Don't ask the question, where did that unlimited mass come from? Don't ask the question, how does it come to exist in a dimensionless point? Don't ask those questions. But there was singularity and it exploded, Big Bang. Don't ask who pushed the plunger either. Just Big Bang. And then another one raised his hand and said, there are two models that say what happens at the other end of the Big Bang. One model is that everything expands and expands and expands and expands, and beyond the point where gravitational pull can no longer hold the universe together, it just dissipates into nothingness. That's one model. Then there's another model that a Harvard professor says things of time are cyclical. What happens is that it implodes back upon itself and becomes a singularity again. And I said, just see, this is a model that says everything starts from nothing, and either this model or that model, it ends in nothing. So what does that tell you about what's going on right now? And the answer is, it's nothing. Life has, it's meaningless. So what's the use of all your calculations and all your speculations? It's all meaningless, meaningless. Very sad state of affairs. But here's another model, the Vedic model, that has all of the same calculations, even before you guys got your calculations. So it's the standard calculations, but it says everything comes from a person and returns back to a person, and that you're also a person. This is a far richer model. It's more sensible, it's more satisfying, and it's not coming from speculation, it's coming from or empiric observation. It's empirical, but it's not based upon empirical observation. Your limited senses, even with extended senses, with nice, powerful telescopes. on what basis? So back to Dr. Benson, I have to believe in something I don't know, I can't see. But through that process of hearing, one can know. And as Krishna says a few times in Bhagavad Gita, without faith, even before you begin some activity, you're defeated. That's not a very... So even material activity requires some faith. We hired this contractor to build this nice building, and he told us there's going to be 2 feet of space between the two buildings. Look at it, it's 5 feet of space between the two buildings. But we hired the guy, basically, and he did a good job, just it's, you know, he's off by 3 feet. Forget where I was. Somewhere they're building a... Where was it? Somewhere here in India. Oh, it was in Chennai. Is it? Yeah. They're building in Chennai. Anyone here from Chennai? They're building a tram that goes to the airport. A little... So they have, you know, where it's easy, they're building the columns that are going to support the train that goes to the airport. But then where there's river and there's other highway and stuff, it's like there's nothing there. But they've got to have it lined up. They can't have one here and one there and one there. It's got to exactly line up. You better have good engineers that are better than the guy that built the building next door to know the distance between this building and that building. So there's some faith in those guys that they're going to line it up. There's faith in any there's faith in any undertaking of this world. To walk across the floor, there's faith that you're not going to fall through the floor. And it's a very reasonable faith. You're not going to fall through the floor. But I've watched some people walk off that ledge and practically tumble on their head because they didn't know that there was two levels over there. But there's some faith just to do anything, to eat, to breathe, to drink water. We exist in a world, the real world that we live in, day to day, there's faith. Otherwise you can't exist. So the criticism that you have to have faith in religion and therefore I don't like it, because you have to have faith. You can have faith in something else. If you don't have faith in this, it's Bhagavad Gita. So by reposing faith in the words of a perfect person, one can have proper knowledge and, as stated here, with proper knowledge, detachment. That's a natural fruit of proper knowledge, is detachment from ignorance. And this banyan tree is born of ignoring the Supreme as the enjoyer and trying ourselves to be the enjoyer. And so there's so many unlimited branches of ways of trying to be the independent enjoyer. With detachment, cut it. Last point, in the purport, Prabhupada has referred to the 10th chapter verse, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo, Krishna is the source. He's saying in this verse, no one knows, but in the 10th chapter he's disclosing, I'm the source. And when one knows that Krishna is the source, iti matva bhajante mam. That's what you, when you have knowledge, you serve the Supreme. What's the source of everything? You serve that source of everything. It's natural. The other is unnatural. It's diseased condition. I don't know who is the source, and I don't serve the Supreme. It's an unnatural state. Very unhealthy. And then people whine and complain, oh, I'm suffering. I've got this misery, that misery. I was supposed to enjoy. Who wrote this program? You did, my dear sir. You're reaping the fruit of the misuse of your free will, so don't whine and complain. Connect to the Krishna channel again. That's what you should do. You tolerate that misuse of free will program that you connected yourself with, and now turn into the right channel. Hear with faith from Krishna and follow that direction that Krishna gives, and you'll reach Krishna. It's darkness, and there in the distance is some light. Just follow that light. Any discussion on this evening's topic or whatever you'd like? No? Okay. Yes.
Can I ask a question on the topic of working together?
Sure.
We see, like, temples and centers where this inspired, where the leadership is very inspiring, which is primarily based on like the principle of purity is the force. A very strong devotee leads the congregation or the temple, etc. We also see that there are cases where certain very enterprising individuals respond to the call of the hour, start a preaching center, and it grows. And it so happens that at some point in time later, there's a problem of working together. Their primary strength was in fundraising and management, but as we grow, there is the problem of working together happens.
I've seen that, yes.
And now the question which arises, there are a group of devotees who are quite new, but they see the problem, they see where it is, what's the source of the problem.
Well, they may not see the source of the problem, they see that there's a problem.
There's a problem, yeah. So, now the question is, they are junior devotees in one sense. They are young devotees, and there are older devotees who have led this congregation. Now, it becomes a problem of etiquette, like
That's right.
To work together and...
Yeah. So?
In such a scenario, how do we move forward in working together?
Several things can be done. One of them that I've seen is gradually things wither and wither and wither to the extent that the leader that had the capacity to pull it together recognizes he doesn't have the ability to maintain it, and then they gracefully turn it over to someone who has more capacity to maintain it than to build it. That's like an ideal. And then there's respect for the person who built it. That happened in Vrindavan, for example. The persons who did the fundraising were not persons who were capable of maintaining it. Without naming the names, there were persons that raised huge sums of money for the Vrindavan temple, and it was a great service that they did. But Prabhupada didn't put them in charge of maintaining it. He put a number of capable people that weren't capable, or more capable people that weren't capable, because it's very difficult to maintain it. So when there's a person in charge, ideally, if there's a person in charge that to whom persons are accountable, and the person in charge recognizes this person is good at building, they're little Lord Brahmas, but they're not Lord Vishnus. So they can be engaged in, you know, where their strength is. Go build another one. At least, you know... But there are other persons, at least here in India, there are persons that are saying, wait a minute, put a cap on building things because we don't have enough people to maintain those things that are built. It depends on the situation, what should be done. So that's another one, is just put a ceiling on, okay, no more expansion. Just let's work on... Prabhupada did like that. There was expansion. Then he used this phrase, boil the milk. Let's focus not on expansion, let's focus on quality. And spoke of things like having restaurants and reading rooms where people could study Prabhupada's books and take prasadam and become purified by taking prasadam. But not especially or specifically for increasing the number of deities and deity worshippers required and things to be maintained. But that which would purify multitudes of people, prasadam, without necessarily there being a commitment from their side, just increasing the purification that way. So some administrative decision that said, let's put a hold on expansion, is one. The person gracefully exiting, or the leader gracefully, you know, resituating that person. And another is just collapse. You know, dissension leading to collapse. This group goes this way and that group goes that way. Then you have two centers that aren't functioning well either. So qualified leadership is essential. And when one finds a qualified leader that can actually build quality within their followers, then you have something that's durable and sustainable. So emphasis on that, working with the leaders so that they have that capacity. Some persons just don't have the capacity to learn. They can build, but they can't maintain. Then it becomes a nightmare, administrative headache to, you know, that person who works so hard to move them to the side. And they feel hurt. But they shouldn't have been in that position to begin with. Unless it was very clear, you can build, but you can't, you know, that's the extent. Wow. In Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, text 40, Krishna says, there's no being existing either here or among the demigods in the higher planetary systems which is freed from these modes born of material nature. Then what about the pure devotees? Please explain. In the 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says something very similar. But he then makes an exception. He says, when the embodied being is able to transcend these modes associated with the material body, he can become free. So, it's the exception. The rule is, everybody's under the modes. The exception is, there are some that can become free from the modes. There's the rule, and then there's the exception to the rule. And then Arjuna asks, well, how do you become free from the modes? What's the means? Wow, a typed question. Okay. When we hear that once there was a time when the entire globe was under King Bharat. Implicit to this is that everyone was following Bhagavad Dharma, worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. From that time to the present times, wherein we have so many religions, deviations, etc., to the extent that instead of accepting Krishna as the Supreme Lord, today's generation believes that human ancestors are monkeys. How does all this happen? What were the major chronological events that took place? Well, the principle that's going on is the modes of nature are acting. Even during the time of Bharat Maharaj, where all over the world there was Vedic culture, there are different gradations of appreciation of that Vedic culture, different levels of faith and following. One major event that took place, which was prior to Bharat Maharaj, was Lord Parashuram driving, killing the kings 21 times throughout all of the land, and some of them fleeing and going to different geographical locations and establishing vestiges of Vedic culture. But those vestiges of Vedic culture over time, so the influence, the event is time passed, and the understandings became mutated over time due to absence of parampara, different views, different values, different teachings. Things deteriorate over time. And so you have different cultures and different languages and different value systems for people all over the world and different ways of worship. There are studies, I'm not one who has done this study, but there are persons who have studied the comparison of the Greek mythology to the pantheon of demigods found in Vedic literature. Zeus is this one and Olympia is that one and so on and so on and so on. So the strong comparison between Vedic culture and Greek culture. And in one visit to Beijing in China, one of the biggest tourist facilities in Beijing is Temple of Heaven. I was very surprised. I didn't want to... The devotee said, "Do you want to go see something?" And I said, "No, I didn't want to see something." "Oh, come on, come see something." "No, come see something, come see something." "Okay, I'll go see something." So they took me to the Temple of Heaven. And skipping a lot of details, it's a gazillion people all over the place. The number of people. For someone that lives in New York and, you know, knows what it's like riding in the subway and rush hour and just watching mobs of people go here and there, it's nothing compared to Beijing. So many people. So many people. And it was a Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. It wasn't even lunch hour. It was in the afternoon. A zillion people. Just sea of people from... huge. Anyway, so the first place that we went to, there's three mounds, and one of them is worship of demigods. You go up this flight of stairs, and then there's a big open area, and there's three buildings, and one taller building is demigod worship. So there's Indra, they didn't say Indra, the king of heaven. He's in the middle in kind of like a U shape going around around the directions. Was the worship of the sun god, worship of the moon god, worship of the water god, worship of the wind god, worship of the demigods. I said, "Wow. China had demigod worship." Then there's the history of the Ming dynasty that created, they did all this stuff. They promoted for centuries this dynasty and that dynasty. I forget the name, Ming and some other one. And that's what they did. They worshipped the demigods. And it's part of their, like the showcase of their museum. They don't practice it now, but they practiced it way back when. So Vedic culture was all over the world, not just, you know, we like to say like that. Another nice explanation comes from Sadaputta when he was doing research into cosmology. He took time to study what scholars have already studied, but he studied it. Cosmology, concept of cultures from all over the world. In short, it's a very close match all over the world. There are differences, but a very close match from Siberia to South America, from Africa to New Zealand, and the American Indians, and all over the world. Scandinavia, similar cosmology. And he writes in the book, the title of the book is forget the title of the book. Ancient Cosmology and Cosmography, or something like that. The scholars that have studied this said there's three possibilities as to how there is such symmetry all over the world. One possibility, the first two possibilities they ruled out. The one is, it's chance. That's not so likely. Second possibility, it's genetically coded in human beings. They must have cosmology like this. And that's not so plausible either. So the third is, there was a culture all over the world that had this picture of cosmology. In different languages and different cultures, they expressed it in different ways, but there was one world culture. They didn't like that one. They said that's the most plausible, but we don't like it. Maybe there's another one we haven't thought of. So there's evidences that in fact there was such culture, not just it says it in the Vedas, and there's empiric evidence to indicate there was such culture all over the world. And in different cultures, people express themselves in different ways. They hold different values, and things change over time without disciplic succession. And that's why we have, according to the modes of nature, we have such diversity. I'm going to read one. Is that all right? I'm going to read one. From where do we receive the tendency to enjoy the fruits of our labor? What kind of fruit should we look for? The tendency is born of contact with the mode of passion. We get that tendency. And once we have that tendency, it's practically impossible to rid yourself of it. But it doesn't mean give up, because it happens by contact with something that's fully pure. But once contaminated by that tendency, we tend to bring that tendency even into the realm of that which is pure, devotional service. It's born of contact with the mode of passion. And those fruits that we should look for is Krishna's enjoyment. That's what this working together is about. We want to see Krishna's enjoyment. And there's standards by which Krishna enjoys, and we look for that. That's the fruit. Krishna becomes happy. Krishna smiles. Go ahead.
After hearing that Aham Sarvasya Prabhu, that natural devotion to worship Krishna should come. But why that desire is strong, desire is not coming, and what are the reasons, and how?
We're conditioned. It's dormant. It's anesthetized. It's there, but it's dormant. It needs to be awakened. And when you're anesthetized, have you ever been under anesthesia? You ever had a surgery or one of those kind of things? When you're under anesthesia, it's not like sleep. There's no sense of passage of time. One devotee, Prithushrava Prabhu, is a god brother who had a tumor in his throat area. And it wasn't cancer, but it was a tumor. And he was trying natural means to make it go away or at least diminish. And it was okay for quite some time, but then it started to grow again, and he couldn't swallow, he couldn't breathe, so he had to have an operation. And skipping so many details, there was an operation under anesthesia, and when he came out of the anesthesia, there was some fluid that had gone into his throat and his lungs, and so he was coughing, and so they gave him additional anesthesia. So it went on for, he's quite healthy now, but it went on for about a day and a half under anesthesia. And he described that when he woke up, it was as like no time had passed at all. I was in New York. I had some, as you get older, there are certain procedures you're supposed to do just to check. Not a problem, but just preventing a problem, catching a problem before. So some procedure, anesthesia. And so, you know, they have you count. You start at 10, you count backwards, and they know when you're gone. So I was lying there and doing, you know, anesthesia. It wasn't over your mouth. It was, you know, intravenously. And then when I woke up, I was looking around the room and saying, when are they going to take me into the, you know, this procedure room? And I looked at the clock, and it was an hour and a half later. And it wasn't at all the feeling like I had been asleep. It's a different. So there's awake, sleep, and deep sleep. And anesthesia is deep sleep. So some people are so covered that, you know, hello. Hello. And, you know, even that is sleep when some are so sound asleep you can't wake them up. And then those that are pretending to be asleep, and that's even more difficult. But whether it's awake, sleep, or deep sleep, they're all three states of consciousness are covered states of consciousness, and the natural condition of the soul is there. Attraction for Krishna is already within the heart. It just needs to be awakened. So we're dull. Sorry to say, but we're dull. And it takes a lot. The potency of chanting and hearing and worshiping and so on, all the potency is there. Full potency is there, but we're covered. That's the situation. Is that all right? Does that address your question?
We should supposed to come out of that deep ignorance.
It takes gradually. Depends on how covered we are and how seriously sincerely we apply ourselves to the process. But yes, we're supposed to. And some it may be more quickly, and some it may be more slowly. But the potential is already there. Okay, we're going to go on. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.